You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your host, Sally Inquieto, would like to remind our listeners the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Hello, Homicide Worldwide listeners. All of us over here at Homicide Worldwide Podcast would like to thank you for coming back each week. We see that you are spreading the word and that our body count is growing. Make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're kind of on Facebook. If you have an idea for an episode, send us an email to homicideworldwidepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to join our moms in supporting the show, check out our Patreon. Please remember to subscribe wherever you listen and please leave a 5-star review. It really helps out the show. For source material, don't forget to check out the show notes. We want to share a podcast that all of us over here at Homicide Worldwide absolutely love. It's called The Cast Files. Here to tell you a little about their show are our friends, Kristen and Dave.
The Cast Files is a podcast where we are watching and discussing every episode of The X-Files, spoiler free.
Greetings, listeners, domestic, international, and extraterrestrial. I'm Dave Reed.
And I'm Kristen Riley, and this is The Cast Files.
I am a nerd who somehow never saw The X-Files.
And I watched it when it originally aired.
I have neglected to mention that there's a bathroom troll.
If we get 100,000 subscribers, I'll get that tattoo on me.
Be sure to check them out wherever you listen to podcasts. Tonight, we pick up where we left off last week, in the minutes before Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson are murdered. They will die this night from multiple sharp force injuries and deep slashing wounds to their throats. In Nicole's case, a wound so severe that she is nearly decapitated. He parks his white Ford Bronco in the alley behind Nicole's South Bundy Drive condo in the upscale Brentwood neighborhood of LA. It's a dark, quiet night. He enters the property through the rear gate. The lock has been broken, as he knew it would be, and it reminded him of all the times he had told Nicole to get it fixed. Ron Goldman has plans. In just a little while, he is going to meet up with another friend after this quick errand to return the glasses belonging to Nicole's mom. He doesn't know he has just minutes left to live. It was a long day. It was late, and Nicole ran a bath. She lit some candles, as she had done a million times before. When she chose the little black sundress earlier that day, the one she wore to her daughter's recital and to the dinner after, she couldn't know that it was a dress that she would be murdered in. As the tabloids ran pictures of Nicole's lifeless body, heaped into a fetal position at the bottom of her front stairs, laying just a few feet away was Ron Goldman, a young man with things to do and places to go, who was so tragically in the exact wrong place at the exact wrong time. Everything is about to change. Two lives will violently end, and families will shatter, a spectacle of a trial will ensue, and end with an impossible verdict. A nation will learn some hard lessons about the literal price of justice. This is part two of the O.J. Simpson case, episode 30 of Homicide Worldwide.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to part two of the O.J. Simpson case. Thank you for coming back, listeners. And thank you, Kita, for being here as well.
Well, thank you for being here as well.
We couldn't do it without us.
Exactly.
So we're just going to dive into part two. And last week in part one, we looked a little more closely at OJ's childhood, as we often do with the killers that we profile, to try to get some clues to his future behavior. And we also examined the life and the personalities of his two victims, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. We took a close look at OJ and Nicole's tumultuous marriage, to say the least, and the events that led up to the night of the murders, which was June 12th, 1994. We also left off last week in the moments right before the murders occurred. So OJ and Ron are both arriving more or less at the same time at Nicole's townhouse on South Bundy Drive in Brentwood. Her kids are asleep and she has a nice candlelit bath happening. She's just about to get in. It's all very peaceful and quiet at her house, but not for much longer. So here we are, the night of June 12th, 1994. This is the day it all ends, but it's also the day that it all begins. So let's jump right in to a couple of different perspectives here. We've got the perspectives of the forensic sort of examiners and what they've pieced together. And that's more or less what we think happened too. And then you've got O.J. Simpson's version of things, which has magical people in it who don't exist. So we're going to start out with the only account that we have of what likely happened that night. And it comes from O.J. Simpson himself.
Right from the horse's mouth.
The horse himself. And he wrote this book called If I Did It, actually before the trial had even ended. So the outcome wasn't even set yet. There wasn't a verdict. He wrote this book supposedly to put out his true story, but it is his account of what he thinks could have been the case, but of course isn't, because it's just a hypothetical. Wink.
Yeah. Wink, wink. Mm-hmm.
Hypothetical,
but highly detailed, in that nobody but the person who committed this crime could have possibly known the level of detail that he wrote about. If he didn't do this, then he was like in touch with, like, I don't know, Miss Cleo, and she told him through her psychic connections exactly what happened.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
Miss Cleo would have had to have been your accomplice for his version to be correct.
Miss Cleo did it.
That would make a lot more sense than what he's trying to run past us.
Kind of would, actually.
Right. So this book that he wrote, which wasn't ever published by him, and the rights were bought by the Goldmans, and they published it themselves.
Well, they were awarded this. Oh,
correct. That's right. They were awarded it, and which they freaking should have been after what they went through.
Yeah. We'll get to that in just a minute, because that is all sort of intertwined with the civil suit that follows the actual trial of O.J. Simpson. But that's coming. Yeah. You're right, though. This book was released because they wanted this out. They view this book not as a hypothetical, but they totally view it as a total confession.
So I'm going to read pretty much verbatim from the book, If I Did It, of the part where he's talking about the night in question. And actually, that is the title of the chapter, The Night in Question. Aptly named, indeed. It's chapter number 6 in this book, If I Did It. And in it, you can probably tell it quickly ceases to sound like a hypothetical and rapidly starts to sound like a true life account.
Yes. I listened to this on audiobook. As I listened to it, I actually stopped what I was doing because I was so just blown away at the coldness and the detail. When you really stop and examine the words and you listen to it and you hear what is being said, it's chilling. Because it's literally his account of what happened.
Of him murdering people.
His ex-wife and a perfect stranger to him.
And a little backup here so that you have some perspective on who he's talking about. In this account, OJ has concocted this person named Charlie, who he's pulled out of his ass.
Charlie lives in OJ's rectum, to be
clear.
It
lives in OJ's ass. A shitty place to be.
Mm. But I'm bumps.
So he does live in OJ's ass.
Oh my God.
And OJ pulls him out for this fucking stupid story. Yeah. Yes. I named Charlie, who like nobody has heard of before or since, but just happened to show up at the exact moment this is all going down.
This massive circle of friends and extended workers and everybody in OJ's life, nobody has ever fucking heard of Charlie.
That's right. Just a ghost.
Yeah.
So this guy just turns up randomly at OJ's house to tell him that he's got really bad news about Nicole, that Nicole's been like dicking around and
has
been seeing all these people and somebody that OJ knows, and it really enrages OJ. And so he and Charlie drive together to Nicole's house, and Charlie's like, no, no, man, don't do it. But OJ goes into the front of her house and into the courtyard.
And as he's driving with Charlie, he's completely describing the streets in Brentwood, where he took a left here and then he did this and he parked there and oh, there was a light here. No, this was an actual event that took place, and Charlie doesn't exist. Charlie, you did this.
So in this little story that I'm about to read to you, this is OJ's account of his, quote, hypothetical encounter. You'll hear him talk about Ron Goldman, and you'll hear Nicole appear in it as well, and I'll do my best with my voices. I slipped past the gate into the narrow courtyard and moved towards the front door, and right away I noticed lights flickering in the windows. I moved past the front door to take a closer look. There were candles burning inside, and I could hear faint music playing. It was obvious that Nicole was expecting company.
Obviously.
Of course, right? She wouldn't just enjoy a nice candlelit bath by herself.
No.
Who does that?
I do.
I wondered who the fuck it was this time. I wondered if maybe Faye was coming over with some of her boy toys so that they could all get wild and dirty while my kids were sleeping upstairs.
Wild and dirty in the bathtub.
Yeah, like while the kids are sleeping upstairs. It's sanity.
It makes so much sense, OJ.
Yeah, she's 35, mother of two. She's not going to be having wild sex upstairs. She's going to be going to sleep early.
Yeah, more than likely, yes.
Right? Just as I was beginning to get seriously steamed, the back gate squeaked open. A guy came walking through like he owned the fucking place. He saw me and froze. He was young and good looking, with a thick head of black hair, and I tried to place him, but I'd never seen him before. I didn't even know his name, Ron Goldman. Who the fuck are you? I asked. I just came by to return a pair of glasses, he replied, stammering. Really? A pair of glasses, huh? Yes, he said. He was carrying an envelope. Judy left them at the restaurant. I'm a waiter at Mezzaluna. So it's Judy, is it? He's talking about Judita, who is Nicole's mom. You're on a first name basis with Judy? At that moment, the gate behind Goldman squeaked again. Charlie, magical Charlie. Uh-huh. Charlie walked into the narrow space. He was carrying the knife. Everything cool here? He asked. I saw this guy walking through the gate, and I just wanted to make sure there wasn't going to be any trouble.
Thanks, Charlie.
This motherfucker wants me to believe he's here dropping off a pair of Judy's glasses, I said. I am, Goldman said, appearing increasingly nervous.
Because OJ's talking to a fucking fake friend.
That's right. I'd be nervous too. Like, who's this guy talking to? Look for yourself. And then what? I said. You were going to the restaurant? No, he said. My shift's over. I'm just leaving these here and going home. You expect me to believe that? I don't expect anything, he said. I'm telling you the truth. You're a fucking liar, I shouted. I'm not, I swear to God. She's got candles burning inside, fucking music playing, probably a nice bottle of red wine breathing on the counter, waiting for you. Not for me, Goldman protested. Fuck you, man. You think I'm fucking stupid or something? Suddenly, the front door opened. Nicole came outside, alerted by our raised voices. She was wearing a slinky little cocktail dress, black, with probably not much on underneath. Her mouth fell open in shock. She looked at me, and she looked at Goldman, and she looked at Charlie, just beyond. How could she see him?
I don't know. Maybe she'd met him before.
Maybe. Goldman was pretty well trapped. Charlie stood between him and the rear gate, and I was barring his way to the front. OJ, what the fuck is going on? I turned to Nicole. That's what I want to know, I said. Cato, the dog. Oh, by the way, the dog Cato was named after Cato Kalin, whose name is actually Brian.
Wasn't Cato an Akita?
Yes.
Oh my God, did you see what I did there? Cato Akita? Yeah.
Cato, the Akita named after Cato Kalin, whose name is Brian.
Oh my God. That was my mind just getting blown, dude.
I know. Can you imagine how our listeners feel right now?
They're like, oh my God.
I was just on the floor staring at the ceiling like, what just happened to my mind?
Fucking eyes dying. Am I tripping on acid, man?
It's for free here at Homicide Worldwide.
That's right. Yeah, we just dosed you, motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did. Cato, the dog, came wandering out of the house. He saw me and wagged his tail, and then Goldman and also wagged his tail. I looked at Goldman, steamed, and Charlie moved closer, the knife still in his hand. I think he sensed that things were about to get out of control because I was very close to losing it. I'm listening, motherfucker, I said to Goldman. OJ, Nicole hollered. Leave him the fuck alone. What are you doing here anyway? I thought you were going to Chicago. Fuck you, I said. I'm just quoting directly, friends, by the way. This is just direct quotes. Hey, man, Goldman said. That's not necessary. Charlie piped in. Let's just get the fuck out of here, OJ. I asked you a question, motherfucker. What are you doing here? You delivering drugs? Leave him alone, OJ, Nicole shouted. I hear you assholes are dealing on the side. Nicole came at me, swinging. Get the fuck out of here, she said. This is my house and I can do what I want. Not in front of my kids, you can't. Fuck you. No, fuck you. I gave you everything you asked for and you fucked it all up. She came at me like a banshee, all arms and legs, flailing, and I ducked, and she lost her balance and fell against the stoop. She fell hard on her right side. I could hear the back of her head hitting the ground, and lay there for a moment, not moving. Jesus Christ, OJ, let's get the fuck out of here, Charlie said, his voice cracking. I looked over at Goldman, and I was fuming. I guess he thought I was going to hit him because he got into his little karate stance. What the fuck is that? I said. You think you can take me with your karate shit? He started circling me, bobbing and weaving, and if I hadn't been so fucking angry, I would have laughed in his face. OJ, come on! It was Charlie again, pleading. Nicole moaned, regaining consciousness. She stirred on the ground and opened her eyes and looked at me, but it didn't seem like anything was registering. Charlie walked over and planted himself in front of me, blocking my view. We are fucking done here, man. Let's go. I noticed the knife in Charlie's hand. And in one deft move, I removed my right glove and snatched it up. We're not going anywhere, I said, turning to face Goldman. Goldman was still circling me, bobbing and weaving, but I didn't feel like laughing anymore. You think you're tough, motherfucker? I said. I could hear Charlie behind me saying something, urging me to get the fuck out of there, and at one point he even reached for me and tried to drag me away, but I shook him off hard and moved towards Goldman. Okay, motherfucker, I said. Show me how tough you are. Then something went horribly wrong, and I know what happened, but I can't tell you exactly how. I was still standing in Nicole's courtyard, of course, but for a few minutes I couldn't remember how I'd gotten there, when I'd arrived, or even why I was there. Then it came back to me, very slowly. The recital, with little Sydney up on stage, dancing her little heart out. Me, chipping balls into my neighbor's yard. Paula. That's his girlfriend at the time. Angry, not answering her phone. Charlie, that's his imaginary friend, stopping by the house to tell me some more ugly shit about Nicole's behavior. Then what? The short, quick drive from Rockingham to the Bundy condo. And now? Now I was standing in Nicole's courtyard, in the dark, listening to the loud, rhythmic, accelerated beating of my own heart. I put my left hand to my heart and my shirt felt strangely wet. I looked down at myself. For several moments, I couldn't get my mind around what I was seeing. The whole front of me was covered in blood, but it didn't compute. Is this really blood? I wondered. Whose blood is it? Is it mine? Am I hurt? I was more confused than ever. What the hell had happened here? Then I remembered that Goldman guy coming through the back gate with Jujita's glasses, and I remembered hollering at him, and I remembered how our shouts had brought Nicole to the door. Nicole, Jesus. I looked down and saw her on the ground in front of me, curled up in a fetal position at the base of the stairs, not moving. Goldman was only a few feet away, slumped against the bars of the fence. He wasn't moving either. Both he and Nicole were lying in giant pools of blood. I had never seen so much blood in my life. It didn't seem real, and none of it computed. What the fuck happened here? Who had done this, and why? And where the fuck was I when this shit went down? It was like part of my life was missing, like there was some weird gap in my existence. But how could that be? I was standing right there. That was me, right? I again looked down at myself, at my blood-soaked clothes, and noticed the knife in my hand. The knife was covered in blood, as were my hand and wrist and half of my right forearm. That didn't compute either. I wondered how I'd gotten blood all over my knife. And again, I asked myself whose blood it might be, when suddenly it all made perfect sense. This was just a bad dream, a very bad dream. Any moment now I would wake up at home in my own bed and start going about my day. Then I heard a sound behind me and turned, startled. Charlie was standing in the shadows a few feet away, his mouth hanging open, his breathing short and ragged. He was looking beyond me at the bodies. Charlie, I called out. He didn't answer. Charlie, still nothing. I went over and stood in front of him and asked him the same question I just asked myself. Charlie, what the fuck happened here? He looked up and met my eyes, but for several moments it was as if he didn't really see me. Are you listening to me? I said. I asked you what happened here. Charlie shook his head from side to side, his mouth still hanging open. His breathing was still short, ragged, and in a voice that was no more than a frightened whisper, said, Jesus Christ, OJ, what have you done?
Well, OJ just killed two people.
That's what he fucking done. And this is his account. So in this account, the actual picking up of the knife and putting it into the bodies of two people again and again.
Yeah.
He doesn't talk about that. In his account, he basically blacks out. Blacking out is not uncommon for people to experience, especially when they do horrific events. Yeah. The brain is just like, you know what? We're just not going to think about that anymore.
That's right. Think about like Norman Bates and the Bates Motel series.
That's right.
Where he blacks out and he doesn't remember a thing about what just happened. It's exactly like that.
That's right.
Except for that this account that OJ has given is so on the money as to exactly what happened, right down to like where we'll never know if she actually came at him like a banshee, as he mm-hmm. said. But according to her autopsy, she did have injuries on her scalp that were consistent with that kind of fall. And not to mention, they were on the right side, just like he detailed.
Exactly. There's just so much in here that lines up so well with the forensic evidence. What's very interesting is how OJ put together certain aspects of the scene and came to the conclusion about what that meant for Ron Goldman. He saw, and remember, at this point, he's got memories in his head, whether they came from imaginary Charlie or somebody else. He's got all these memories in his head of Nicole being with other guys, and he's pretty enraged about it. And so arriving at Nicole's townhouse and seeing her through the window in the bathroom and the soft candlelight, and she's in her pretty dress, like, he's like, she's got a guy coming.
Yeah. And then Ron shows up at the exact wrong time.
The exact wrong time. Ron, who's just delivering a pair of glasses, he's got plans for right after this.
Yeah.
His friends confirmed that to the police later. He is not here for Nicole. He's here to drop off the glasses.
Exactly. And the other thing that I find really interesting is OJ mentions the karate stance. We said earlier that he had like a third degree black belt. And so how in the world could OJ have put that together, unless this is literally just for some dramatic effect?
That he read about it in Goldman's biography and put it in himself.
And I just don't even think that OJ Simpson has the fucking bandwidth to put that in the details of what happened. Although, I mean, if you listen to him, he is a self-described voracious reader.
He's just everything that everybody wants.
Anybody who knows me knows I'm a voracious reader.
And a good guy. He's just a good guy.
Yeah, let me just fucking break my arm while I'm patting myself on the back.
According to this account by him, he has somehow murdered two people in this sort of blackout frenzy stabbing time. And now he has to deal with the fallout of it.
Right. I think it's worth mentioning that Nicole Brown Simpson at the time of her murder was 129 pounds. Ron Goldman was 171 pounds, give or take. He was definitely not in the same weight category as OJ. He wasn't as tall. He didn't, you know, they were kind of, you know, there was a featherweight and heavyweight there. But in terms of Nicole, OJ outweighed her by almost 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, she was only about 5'5". He's 6'2". Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she wouldn't have ever had a chance against him. no matter what. Ron Goldman, maybe I'm a little iffy on that. Like, you know, especially in a blind rage like that. But still, I mean, you just think about this small woman who's petite and light against this giant athlete.
She didn't really have a chance.
She did not have a chance.
And in terms of the forensics, there are not a lot of wounds on O.J. Simpson. But two things. First, he's wearing gloves. And secondly, he's the one holding the knife.
Right.
So, and he's also a very large and very strong man.
Yeah. And I'm sure has a pretty long reach.
Absolutely. And these things are definitely in his favor. So our timeline continues to advance at this point. At about 10:15, which is the time right now, the neighbors on either side of Nicole's house hear her dog barking.
This is Kato Akita.
That's right. And so the prosecutors think that this is the time that the murders happened, when the frantic dog barking could be heard. And that lines up very well with the timeline. OJ actually had a flight to Chicago that night to do some business. The flight was to leave at 11:45. So he's on a really tight timeline, and he actually needs to get back to his own house on Rockingham as quickly as possible, because there's a limo driver there waiting to pick him up and take him to the airport.
Yes. And because of when this was, remember, we're in mid-90s here. This is pre-9/11. And so there wasn't the security. You could cut your flight a little close.
That's right.
And so if you're wondering, like, well, there's no way, like, in terms of making it through TSA, they had fucking metal detectors. That was right. It wasn't a big production like it is nowadays. If you were running late, like in the Hertz commercial where he's running through the airport, that could literally be a thing.
That's right. And they're going to hold the plane for O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, they're not going to. It's not like me where, like, I'm when I went to go visit you and I missed my flight. I'm not nearly as cool as O.J. They would not hold the plane.
So at about 10:22, Alan Park, who is the limo driver who's going to take O.J. from his house on Rockingham to LAX for his trip to Chicago, pulls up and arrives there, and he kind of waits. He waits for O.J. to come out, as you do. And he waits and waits. He waits for about 20 minutes. And then finally, he rings the buzzer and he gets no answer, which he's not expecting, because he's hoping that OJ will come out and get in the damn limo so he can take him to the damn airport. About this time, Kato Kalin hears three distinct thumps on his wall near his air conditioner, which is unusual. He kind of goes out to inspect and see what it is, but he doesn't really find anything. Around the same time, Alan Park, the limo driver, calls his boss and says, "Hey, no one's answering at OJ's house. What should I do?" So Alan Park and Kato Kalin are, you know, more or less in the same place. And they see a tall African-American figure walk up to the front door. And not long after that, OJ comes out of the house and with his stuff and starts to load the limo. He's had freshly showered. He's ready to rock and roll.
"I overslept, man.
Oh, man, I just overslept. It wasn't that I killed someone."
Totally didn't just murder my ex-wife and a friend.
Didn't
of
do
hers.
That. Mm-hmm. Why would I even say that?
I was here the whole time. Why would you think that?
Yeah. Don't even say it out loud. Oh, wait, that was me.
Yeah. It was Charlie. Charlie did it. Now he's back in my butthole.
You've got to make your fun in this crazy world, people. Dear. OJ comes out of the house and he puts his bag in the limo. And then he talks with Kato, who's like, "I heard these like thumps on my wall, man. Maybe it was an intruder." And so he and Kato look together for the quote intruder, and they don't find anybody.
To be fair, the knocks could have been Kato's intestines after the McDonald's.
It could have been. And he just couldn't trace the sound or triangulate where it came from.
Exactly.
It's not technically food.
Uh-uh.
So they leave for the airport at about 11:15. And remember, the plane leaves at 11:45. Okay, you've got to get to LAX and to your plane in half an hour. But okay, you're a celebrity. I guess that's how it rolls.
And also, too, like, you can't count on the fact that, like, just because it's a late hour, there isn't going to be traffic. It's fucking LA, people. There's traffic all the time. It makes no difference what time of day it is. There is that's traffic. Right.
I don't care if it's the mid-90s as well. There's traffic.
Yes.
Yeah, a million years ago, dinosaurs and traffic.
Yeah. Dinosaurs are on the 405.
So they're on their way to the airport. About half an hour later, one of the people who lives in this area, who is friends with a neighbor of Nicole's, Nicole's dog has been found kind of roaming in the area, barking a little bit.
A little bloody.
This, A little bloody, yeah. This neighbor notices red spots on the dog's paws and legs.
The dog's not hurt. This is not dog blood.
No, we would have already talked about how sad we are if the dogs were going to get hurt. Because as everybody who listens to this knows, we like animals more than people.
Exactly. So, no, this is just dog footies tracking human blood.
Tracking human blood and a lot of human blood.
Yes.
Not long after that, just minutes after, the neighbor notices that there is what looks like blood on the dog's paws and legs and on its face. OJ flies out of LA.
Yeah.
On American Airlines flight 668 to Chicago.
If only it had been 666.
If only whatever. The circle would be complete.
It really would be.
Mm-hmm. And then at midnight, almost right on midnight, the neighbor of Nicole's who has the Akita, who's got the blood on its paws, they decide to take it for a little walk because it's very agitated. And the dog basically drags them to Nicole's condo. It's not hard to see what has happened because all you need to do is look through the fence, which is like a sort of metal, like bars, like a jail. Sounds gross when I describe it, but it's nice. That kind of fence. You can look, right? It's a horrible jail. No, it was nice. And it's Brentwood. It's fancy. And so they look through and they can see blood on the ground, a lot of blood, the blood flowing between the bricks. Lots of blood has been tracked around by the dog walking through the puddles of blood. And then way up near several steps that lead up towards the front door, at the bottom of those steps, lying on the brick pathway, curled in the fetal position on her left-hand side with her hand up near her throat, dead, is Nicole. There's just a vast amount of blood. At that point, they can't see Ron Goldman. He's kind of slightly tucked a little bit around the corner. He's very close, but they can't see him. But that's enough. They've seen all they need to see. They call the police. And this all gets underway.
To go into some of their injuries, and to be very clear, they both, according to their autopsy reports, were killed by multiple sharp force injuries. Ron's were a little less than Nicole, albeit they were still fatal. He had sharp force wounds to the neck, which were several inches wide. He had several stab wounds to his chest. He had several stab wounds into the kind of bottom part of his lateral area. And all of them essentially perforated vital organs. And when they did his autopsy, there were lots and lots of milliliters of blood inside of the body cavity that did not belong where it was. So everything that he sustained, he bled to death. And there was one wound in his neck that was described as gaping.
Yes, it was like a 3x3.
Yes, it was enormous. That's a big fucking wound.
It's a very large wound.
Yeah, he'd been stabbed in the thigh, and he had just, I don't even know. I kind of lost track of how many defensive wounds he had on his hands and on his forearms. But from what you could tell from the autopsy, he put up a good fight, but it was no match against that size of knife and OJ in a rage. Now, in terms of Nicole's injuries, she definitely had a much more severe list of injuries. As you had kind of described earlier when OJ described her coming at him as a banshee, and I had mentioned that she did have an injury to her head that was consistent with what he had recounted, it was a blunt force injury to her head. It wasn't a fatal injury, but it was enough to, in the post-mortem examination, I guess they shave the head to see certain injuries. And in this case, it was a pretty big, like, 2-inch by 1.25-inch size bruise. It looked like it had hemorrhaged. So that was very consistent with what OJ describes in his hypothetical scenario. In addition to that, she had a lot of this was a lot of medical terminology. What it boils down to is her neck was essentially, her throat was slit.
Yeah.
And it was slit in such a severe manner that it was down to the cervical spine.
Cut her spinal cord.
It was nearly a decapitation.
Yeah, it was just hanging on by a little bit. No, it was a horrific wound. She had many non-survivable wounds, as did Ron Goldman. The one on her throat was the one that bled her out, essentially.
Yeah, it was over 5 inches in length. Mm-hmm. Which, if you measure
carotid arteries and the jugular vein as well.
Exactly. And so if you measure your neck, it's probably not quite 5 inches.
Mine's more like 7.
Mine's about, I just don't even have a neck anymore.
Like Joel Godjimmick. Oh,
gross. but in all seriousness, she had roughly 7 stab wounds to her neck and scalp area.
God. I mean, frenzied is the word that comes to mind.
Right.
If you think about the number of different wounds in different places on the body of both of the victims.
And the fact, too, that she had the transection of her left and right carotid arteries.
That's right.
Like, that is a massive wound.
Just huge. I mean, like you said, almost a decapitation. Blah.
And that's how people described it. I have not actually looked at the photos of that. I've seen the crime scene photos. That's one I don't really want to see.
No.
Yeah.
I made the error of looking. You know, once you look, you can't unlook.
You can't. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like roadkill. You know, you're going to think about those intestines all day long.
Right.
And it was unpleasant. I shouldn't have done it.
Yeah. I almost did it. I actually had typed it in and I was like, don't do this.
So smart. Woman of a certain age knows herself and is wise.
If you were at my level of wisdom, you would have known. Mm. Yeah.
So if we look at the forensic evidence, what the reconstructions tell us about what happened, the best thing that they can tell us, or the best information they can give us is this, that the attacker, we're just going to call him the attacker at this point. We know it's O.J. Simpson. The attacker first stabbed Nicole Brown from behind like a fucking coward. Then stopped and left her incapacitated, but not dead, to take care of Goldman, took down Goldman, and then returned to kill her. The reconstruction suggests that Goldman might have arrived during his attack on Nicole, interrupting him and prompting Goldman's own murder. And based on the severity of those defensive wounds that you mentioned on his arms and hands, and that Goldman still had the glasses in his hand when he was found, the people who were investigating believe that the entire attack took no longer than 5 minutes and that he barely had time to get through the gate. So there's a couple of things about that that are a little weird to me. One of them is that Ron's arrival to me really does seem like the catalyst for things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And OJ frames it that way as well. And I don't have any reason to disbelieve that part.
Yeah.
That like the candles and the bath and the little black dress and then the young, handsome man just like really confidently walking through the front gate, as OJ says in the book, like he owned the place.
Yeah.
And I think a massive misunderstanding happened and it all just went down from there.
Well, because OJ was already making the story up in his head, right? He'd already like had the beginning, the middle, and the end. And Ron Goldman showing up in that moment solidified and brought out all of his insecurities. And it only made sense to him at that point.
There's also, though, the fact that at this point, OJ is on her property wearing black leather gloves, holding a knife,
yeah,
wearing
hello.
A knit cap. Like, he's not there to say hi and have a cup of coffee.
No, he's not there for the open wine and the bath.
No, he's not. And so the question then becomes, would this have been the end of Nicole, regardless of whether Ron Goldman turned up at that moment or not? Or was OJ just going there to bluster and scare her, but then Ron Goldman shows up and it just confirms to OJ all of his suspicions about Nicole and her seeing other guys and all this stuff. So yeah. That we might never have an accurate answer to.
To me, knowing what we know about this whole case, that given the age of this case, with all the evidence that's out there, with all the people who have given testimony, who have given interviews, like across the board, that to me, I think is the most viable and realistic option out of all of them. I mean, you know, whether she was or wasn't going to hook up with Ron Goldman, I don't think she was, but whether she was or wasn't, it wasn't any of OJ's business. They were through, they were done. There's something that I don't think we mentioned previously at the recital that, you know, OJ was talking to people and he, in this book, describes running into a friend of his who had said something to the effect of, we don't know the half of what these girls are getting up to, meaning Nicole and her new circle of friends who OJ really didn't like. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, this set in motion the wheels of OJ's imagination that maybe that was what manifested Charlie. And it was all these things that had happened over the last year, over the last month since they called it quits. Mm-hmm. In this day, he saw his in-laws who aren't his in-laws anymore. He saw his daughter and he had to not sit with her mother. And mm-hmm. he saw this friend who then said these things to him. And it was just this culmination of emotion, of the finality of their relationship.
According to Faye Resnick, Nicole saying to OJ, get away from us, get out of my life. You're not welcome with this family anymore.
Exactly. It was like the final nail in the coffin of their relationship. And so mm-hmm. him going over there, you know, he had all this time. He's probably at his house pacing back and forth, you know, like a just a wild animal. Angry because he's not a part of her life anymore. Angry because he's not welcome anymore. Pacing back and forth, thinking about all the things that she's got to be doing with all these different men. If you think about how he approaches Ron Goldman, like, what do you have in there? Drugs? No, it's fucking sunglasses. I know it's drugs. You know, he's
really anti-drugs.
He's manifesting all of these things in yeah. his, you know, to make them come true. You know, meanwhile, they really were sunglasses. But in OJ's mind, it had to be something completely sinister. She had to be having these wild orgies. You know, it couldn't be what you said. She's 35. She's fucking tired. She's got two kids. She just wants to take a bath and go to bed.
Right, exactly.
In OJ's mind, she's going to go fuck the town yeah. and everybody's going to laugh at him.
The story that he made up had to fit his worst suspicions.
Yes.
Because they made him the victim. They made him the one who suffered. They make her the villain. They make her the one who's inconsiderate. I mean, there's a lot of, I can see the freedom in placing yourself as the one who's hard done by. And that's the narcissist's favorite game, right?
Is, yeah.
It was not my fault. It was done to me by that person.
Exactly. And that yeah. was such a consistent thing throughout their marriage. The finger pointing, it was Nicole started it. Mm-hmm. It was like, what are you for? Pointing the finger at your wife, whether she started it or not. Like, take responsibility for your actions, OJ. Orenthal.
So OJ's in Chicago, and this is now a murder scene. As it turns out, the detectives turn up and they start going through a lot of evidence that's on the scene and trying to get a sense for what happened here. One of the detectives is named Mark Furman.
Aww.
Oh, Mark Furman. Super racist guy.
Oh, so he's so go ahead sweet.
He's awful. So go ahead and just bookmark that in your head, Detective Mark Furman. So he arrives, he starts looking through the evidence. The evidence collection in this case is one of the things that was pretty darn shoddy. But before we get to all of the problems with the evidence and the evidence collection, we're just going to kind of go over the next few days. So OJ's in Chicago. And one of the detectives on the case calls him to tell him that his wife has been murdered.
Yeah. And it was crazy, too, because the way they describe it, they're like, we called the hotel and we were like, is OJ there? And they're like, one moment, sir. Like, you just patch him through to OJ's room or what?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
And right? then OJ picks up and then is not really seemingly all that moved about.
Like, oh my God, my wife died. Now, if I told you that somebody that you love had died, your first question would be, how did it happen?
What the fuck happened?
You would want to know how they died.
Yeah.
OJ Simpson does not ask this detective how his wife died.
Right.
He's, oh no, I'll be on the first plane back, he says, and very quickly gets off the phone. And the first thing the detective notes when he gets off the phone with OJ is, he didn't ask me how his wife died.
It's like when Jennifer Pan cried without tears.
That's right. And she holds the like Kleenex to her face that comes away dry.
Yeah, she just makes all the terrible cry faces and nothing actually comes out. It's like,
Jennifer,
you just succeeded in contorting your face, Jennifer.
It's a fucking rookie move.
Well, OJ, rookie yeah. move, pal.
Yeah, don't fake cry. Unless you know how to produce real fucking tears out of your eyeballs.
Exactly.
Thank you. Fucking it's just a...
Just murder 101, people.
So they call OJ. He's, quote, shocked, but is uninterested about how his ex-wife, who he still, you know, has a close-ish bond with because of their children, how she passed away. He gets on the next plane back and he's back in LA. Over the next couple of days, OJ's mental state begins to deteriorate. So about 4 days later, it's Nicole's funeral. That's the 16th of June. So OJ actually turns up to Nicole's funeral. And there's a viewing, an open casket viewing.
Her mother wanted that.
Mm. He walks in with his children, her children too, one in each hand. And he sits them down and then he walks down to the casket, which is open. Now, the mortician has done an excellent job. Her mouth apparently didn't look quite right.
It didn't look right.
And she was wearing an extremely high-necked dress, as you can probably imagine. There's only so much you can do with that whole situation. So he's there at her coffin for a while and he leans down, kisses her, he talks with her. And at some point he's like looking around and kind of touching her body. And somebody came close by and said, you know, we need you to stop touching the body now. And it was like he was looking for something. And apparently he was looking for a ring.
Yeah, to see if she was wearing it in death.
Like he was trying to slide it off.
He's so like, hey, give me that back.
I swear he's trying to do that.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, my God. Well, so, yeah.
It was also said by several people at that funeral that he was overheard apologizing to her. Mm-hmm. As he was leaning over her coffin, just saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Again and again and again. And that's easily defensible. I mean, you can say, I'm sorry for, you know, our marriage not working out. It's easy to justify it, but
yes.
We all know what he was apologizing for.
In this case, I think that it was, I'm sorry for murdering you, Nicole.
Sorry for murdering you.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. My bad.
Not long after the funeral, the detectives put enough together that they have a warrant out now for OG's arrest. And the police inform him through his lawyers that he's going to be arrested for 2 counts of murder. This continues to mess with his mental state. He's kind of racked with what we assume to be guilt and also concern about himself, probably more concern about himself.
I would think that, yes.
Yeah. What's going to happen to him? He's freaking out. His friends are all there. They're all trying to calm him down. You have to just go. You have to like go talk to the cops. They need you to come in. There's a warrant. They kind of talk and they kind of agree that he's going to come in. But before that can happen, something happens that literally shuts down this country while everybody's glued to their screen. And that is that OJ Simpson gets in the car of his buddy AC. Now, AC has been around with OJ for a really, really long time.
Like since college football.
Yeah, they've been friends forever, like us.
Exactly like us.
Mm-hmm. And so many similarities.
Who's OJ in this case, you or me?
It's probably me.
Okay, that's fair. I'll be AJ. Yeah. Or wait, no, AC. Isaac. I'll be Isaac.
So it turns out that AC idolizes OJ Simpson so much.
Oh, so much.
That he also bought a white Bronco.
I mean, I would buy a white Bronco for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But
they're great cars.
Oh, it was such a good year. Man, that is such a good body style. I love that.
It is. It's solid, I love that body style. Tall. It's very nice proportioned. Mm-hmm. And it's great for doing a slow chase down Southern California freeways.
Exactly.
That's what it gets used for. So OJ at this point, he's really in a distressed state of mind. And he gets into the back of the Bronco with a gun. And he tells AC, just drive. And so AC starts driving. And he's got his like shitty little cellular phone, which is like super fancy at the time.
It's like the 1994 version of like an awesome mobile device.
Right, it weighs like 12 pounds.
It's a brick.
And so they're driving around and they talk to the cops. They call the cops, they call their lawyers, they go back and forth. There are apparently like 20 or 30 phone calls that OJ Simpson makes from the Bronco while it's driving around. And it gets on to the point where he gets on the freeway. People start to kind of know where he is. Like people around LA start kind of calling it in because it gets onto the news and people are talking about it. OJ Simpson, he's wanted for the arrest of his wife and this guy, Ron. And now he's in this Bronco and he's driving around Los Angeles. And it became this thing. And because it was happening on the news at the same time, people were aware of it. They came out, they got on bridges and they waved. They made freaking signs. Apparently OJ's, one of the questions he said to AC was, when did they find time to make all these signs?
I was wondering that myself. We were talking about that. We're like, these people just like had freaking cardboard. Like, okay, you were at home. Like maybe you have a box, but like you had a Sharpie and How did this happen?
Maybe people just prepared for any time they need to protest or support.
It is LA and things happen.
It's a crazy town. And so speaking of crazy, so this scene is just absolutely remarkable. It's a chase, but when you think of chase, you think of high speed. Go ahead and slow that way on down in your brain. And like a Walkman that's running out of batteries. That's the speed of this fucking chase. So it's on the freeway and there's other cars kind of around at the same time. It's this one Bronco with like 40 freaking LAPD patrol cars like trailing after it. It's like the lead swan with all the other swans flying behind.
No, exactly.
It.
Somebody described it as a motorcade.
It was like a motorcade, and it's a motorcade with, you know, stressed out freaking AC in the front. You've got OJ in the back with a gun, crying and stressed and like in an altered state of like panic and existential dread, calling everybody he knows, yelling about his life, blah, blah, blah. Me, OJ, OJ, OJ. So they finally talk him down. He agrees that he will go back home to the Rockingham house.
Rockingham Palace.
The Rockingham Palace, if you will. And that he will be arrested there. They'll take him into custody there.
I'll be arrested, but only at my home.
On my terms.
Exactly. I'll tell you when I'm arrested.
That's right. This is, of course, a courtesy that the police extend to all criminals in the United States.
It certainly is. I mean, every criminal.
Yeah, every criminal. Gently arrested at the time and place of your choosing. So that's what happens to O.J. Simpson. He arrives back at his house. The police are there. They're very tense, but they let him go back inside. He kind of cleans himself up. He gets arrested. He goes to prison. Well, he goes to jail.
Yes.
Prison is where you go for a long time. Jail's where you go while you're waiting your trial.
Prison's not where he went.
He's not where he went.
Well, no, he did. He did actually eventually.
But not for this. Exactly. So at this point, the media circus has really taken off. All eyes, because of the Bronco chase, I mean, all eyes were caught already on this, but the Bronco chase that was just like stopped our regular coverage of whatever to bring you this amazing Bronco chase that's happening. I mean, it shut things down.
People interrupted the fucking NBA playoffs.
So he surrenders and he's taken into custody and he's arrested on 2 charges of first degree murder. So now that OJ's in custody, shit gets really real. It's already pretty real, but things get really crazy from here on out. And that is where the details of this case really start to flesh out. The first thing we have to look at is the evidence that was taken.
Yes.
There were a lot of problems with the evidence. First, there was massive amounts of evidence.
It was like it was everybody's first fucking day on the job. Oh, and they had never gone to school or had any kind of training.
There were so many mistakes. Another part of this whole thing with the DNA was that DNA was very new and people didn't talk about it. Now we've got CSI this and CSI that and Special Victims Unit. And DNA, I mean, they don't really portray it very accurately in terms of like, you know, how long it takes to do the tests. But the public in general has a better understanding of what DNA is, how it works, how law enforcement uses it to confirm people's guilt or innocence. And at this time, it was very, very new. People didn't really understand it. The common layman did not understand it, and the jury didn't really understand it as well.
Right.
Plus, when you say things like, you know, there's a 1 in 175 million chance that this person could not have committed the crime, then what the jury is hearing is, oh, then there's a chance that they couldn't have committed the crime.
Then there's a chance that they didn't do this. Exactly.
They're not hearing the odds are so overwhelming. And part of doing good science is not saying things like it's impossible when there is a 1 in 175 million chance. You do have to say these things to be accurate. Yeah. Understanding what that means. That means it's more or less impossible.
Well, it wasn't a common thing. Like now we rely heavily on DNA. It's almost where without it, we can't function in a trial. We can't, you know, we can't move forward. Whereas like, you know, back then it was foreign.
So the evidence continues to pile up. One of the most egregious mistakes that was made involved a bloody fingerprint. I mean, a fingerprint is about the best freaking evidence that you can get. So on the gate, there was a bloody fingerprint that was noted and observed. It was first documented by Detective Mark Furman. He was one of the first people to arrive on the scene, right? He noted it, he wrote it down, but then he didn't take any action to sort of secure its safety.
Right.
So Furman's shift ends And the way that happens when you've got an active crime scene, you hand it over to the next people. It's like, okay, well, it's 10 a.m. I'm clocking off. Here's what's happening.
Yeah, there's like a chain of command.
That's exactly right. And you have to kind of hand things off. So the detectives who took over the shift next were never aware of the fingerprint. And it was either lost or destroyed without it ever being collected as evidence.
Way to go.
A vastly important piece of evidence just shat on.
They're not going to win the Heisman Trophy for evidence collection.
Not this year.
No, or ever.
It doesn't exist. But apart from that, they're never going to win it. Other items of evidence, there were quite a lot, were either not logged or they weren't entered into evidence. They weren't given proper chain of custody. It wasn't sloppy across the board, but there were enough mistakes that it started to create an impression of sloppiness, mm-hmm. an impression that could almost be twisted into being deliberate. Maybe these people are being deliberately sloppy. Maybe they're deliberately erasing evidence.
Yeah.
So bookmark that sort of suspicion because we're going to come back to it. There was genuine sloppy mishandling mm-hmm. of evidence. There were things like, there's like a scale that you put next to items. It's got like inches in black and white, and you put it near an item that you're photographing so that you can see how big it is. It's like if you're photographing something for Craigslist, you put like a quarter near it yes. so that everyone knows how big it is. A lot of photos were taken without scales, which is not, you know, the worst thing that's ever going to happen in evidence collection, but it's just one more little piece of this kind mm-hmm. of shady looking puzzle.
Yeah.
A lot of items had photographs taken of them, but they weren't labeled and they weren't logged. So, you know, where they do that thing where they put that little tinted card that says yeah. 9 or 27, you know, so that you know where each piece was. A lot of that didn't happen. Wet items were sometimes packaged before they were allowed to dry. If you put something wet into a plastic bag and it's sort of summertime in LA, and you wait a couple of days, it's going to change. There's going to be bacterial growth. And that creates changes in the evidence that can render some of it completely useless. And that's yeah. exactly what happened.
Well, and pieces of evidence that were supposed to be separately collected were bagged together.
It's so stupid.
Why?
They cross-contaminate. Like, those are just really 101 things. I mean, yeah. even like a common layman like myself would know that every piece of evidence gets its own bag unless there's a compelling reason to put them together. So a lot of little shitty things like that. Did you read the one about the blanket?
I sure did.
Tell that one.
From inside the house. From inside her own house, they used a blanket to cover Nicole Brown's body. Now, it was her blanket, but it didn't belong on her body that was being processed for this crime that had taken place. It can contaminate. What if she'd had a friend over and that friend had hair that fell out, or there was any kind of forensic evidence? And obviously all of this was still kind of in its infancy at this time. But if there was anything that wasn't a part of the crime scene specifically, it was now, which mm-hmm. makes it contaminated.
You don't know what came from what.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Keita.
You're welcome.
They also didn't really pay attention to where they were putting their feet. Mm-mm. So when you got giant puddles of blood,
step over it.
So the dog's been tracking around. So the dog has tracked some of the blood.
The dog is fired.
So fired. Worst Akita ever. The perpetrator walked around and smeared a little of it. But beyond that, basically all of LAPD trooped through there. The other thing, and this is a little gross, but this is what it is. When you see the tabloid photographs of Nicole dead, you see a very salacious image. The dress is very short. It's hiked up on her thighs. She's got long, great legs. Her blonde hair is over her face. You know, she's like a quote, pretty corpse. And it's a horrific thing to think, but there were a lot of people who just wanted to come see it.
Yeah.
And see her. There was the notoriety factor, the fact that she was a beautiful woman who had died wearing a skimpy dress, the fact that there was a massive slash throat injury, the fact that there was blood everywhere. There were a lot more people on that crime scene than there needed to be.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of that was because of who she was, how she looked, and the nature of the crime. It was honestly very egregious how many people were allowed to walk through.
I have to say, in terms of the dress, I feel like there was just such a big deal made about how quote unquote short or skimpy or whatever.
It's not that short. I mean, it rode up on her legs, but it's like, it was like above her knees.
She was laying in a slump of her own dead body.
That's right. Wait, exactly. That's what a dress will do.
She's just going to freaking like take a moment before she collapses for the final time and like scooch her dress down so that people aren't fucking modest. Offended. No, exactly. Get over it.
And something about that, I'm sure, attracted a lot more people than that was meant to be.
People are gross.
People are gross. So one of the last aspects of evidence collection that really was a mess was O.J. Simpson's blood. So this was a really big deal in the trial. There was a person who had to draw O.J.'s blood to match with various blood on the scene. And the technician who took his blood did not actually make note of how much he had taken. And so when asked, he said, 8 milliliters. It was 8 milliliters. He just said it, even though he didn't know for sure. Now, because there was no documentation of exactly how much was taken, here's the problem. They could only account for about 6 milliliters of OJ's blood. Probably just because the guy hadn't correctly written down how much he took out. But there was this, all this scandal about the missing blood. What happened to the missing blood? Maybe somebody took the missing blood and put it in all the places where OJ's blood was found. Huh? Maybe they did that. And so it was just one more piece of doubt that was used by OJ's defense team to kind of instill doubt. It was just an inattentive moment. This is why the forensics needs to be so precise.
Yeah.
Because a very clever defense team can cast doubt on the evidence of an entire case. And that's what happens here. The blood that was collected from OJ wasn't actually turned over as evidence as well, but it just sat around for a couple of hours. And so it kind of lost being in the chain of custody, which is not cool for very specific evidence like this. In the LAPD storage and also in their labs, there were a lot of pieces of evidence that had been accessed and even changed by unauthorized people.
Yeah, and who was this like unauthorized personnel? Like, how in the world does something like this happen on a crime scene, a major crime scene? Mm-hmm. For one, but then like a crime scene of this magnitude in terms of who is involved, like how the fuck does this happen? How did they fuck everything up so badly?
I know, it's just again and again. I mean, for example, after the Bronco was impounded and taken to LAPD storage, it was entered at least twice in the impound yard. This could be people who are there for a thrill, like some like guy's cousin is in town and he's like, hey man, let's come in and we're just gonna go check out the Bronco.
To be clear, this is the Bronco that belonged to
AC.
This is the Bronco that belonged to OJ. Because OJ's Bronco is the one that was used the night of the murders, supposedly, hypothetically. Mm-hmm. The Bronco that AC had was the one that was used in the chase. So this one that's impounded is actually the one that OJ drives, but it's not really even technically his. It belongs to Hertz.
Really?
Uh-huh.
It's disappointing.
Yeah.
There's blood evidence in the Bronco. There's his blood. There's her blood. There's blood. There's blood in the Bronco. On the door, smeared around inside. So,
it's a tan interior. It's going to show up.
It's really going to show. Right from the start, there were problems with the evidence. And one of the big problems for the prosecution who was trying to get OJ convicted during the trial was that all of this gave an impression of shadiness and conspiracy where there was probably just incompetence.
Yes. Copious amounts of incompetence.
Some of the worst incompetence came in the form of one of the witnesses, which was Detective Mark Furman.
Oh.
Remember Detective Furman? He was one of the first on the case.
He's the one who we always say, oh.
Oh, God, Mark Furman. Mark Furman, everyone can disagree, is kind of a shit. So a whole bunch of stuff happened around Mark Furman. And if you really want to go into detail and really dive into this trial, go check our case notes and you will see some links. I could definitely recommend The People versus O.J. Simpson on Netflix is a deep dive into the trial and very dramatic and very fun and very silly at the same time.
Yes, for sure. Mark Furman in and of himself is like a whole episode. To not completely get away from the actual case, he did play a massive role in this from the beginning of this through the trial. And like you said, I definitely think that if somebody's really interested in like dissecting who he was slash is in terms of how he's related to this, you should definitely check that out in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. What he's known for, apart from being a racist and being on tape saying some horribly racist things and also saying some things about the way that he did his job of being a police officer in ways that were very violent and aggressive towards the Black community, he also used the N-word so many times. And he was asked in his first testimony under oath if he had ever used the N-word to describe another person. No, I have not. And then these tapes came out that he had recorded where he is using this language.
He's just dropping an N-bomb everywhere he goes.
And then a little later down the track, when he's brought back in and all this comes out, he's asked directly if he ever falsified police reports or planted evidence in the Simpson case. Now, this is a really important moment in the trial, because when he is asked this question, it's an opportunity to take one of two paths. One is the LAPD has followed the rules and can be trusted, or the LAPD is directly undermining the Black community.
Yeah.
Trying to take down Black men by faking stuff and lying.
Yeah, they're racist liars is what it boils down to.
That's right. That was the impression that the Black community had of the LAPD. Remember, this is all happening in this tension following the LA race riots after the beating of Rodney King.
Yeah.
This atmosphere is very, very laden with suspicion and mistrust.
A lot of tension.
The police. A lot of tension. So when asked this question directly, if he falsified police reports or planted evidence, Mark Furman invokes his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
That doesn't look good for you, Furman.
It doesn't look good, man. I mean, it could have been something as simple as like, you wipe something away or you, I don't know. It doesn't have to be something big, but it's enough. It's enough to plant a doubt in the minds of the jury that maybe he was set up. If this guy's like pleading the fifth when asked if he falsified police reports or planted evidence in the Simpson case, when he's asked that point blank and he invokes the fifth, I mean, if you're the jury, you're like, that's shady AF.
Oh, 100%.
So I don't really think that Mark Furman did that. I think he was trying to cover his ass. But it was enough, again, for there to be a significant amount of doubt. The defense's role in this case, in the trial, I don't know if you know too much about this, dear listener, but they were called the Dream Team. It was basically the biggest freaking ego jerk-off circle of a, like, high-power alpha male that you could possibly imagine.
They literally did not need women in their lives because they just fucked their own egos.
They had big egos, big power. It was a bunch of dick swinging, a lot of courtroom sort of swagger. But I mean, they had swagger because they were good at their jobs, and their jobs were finding the loopholes and getting their peeps off in a lawyerly sense. So we had a couple of different people on the team. One of them was Johnny Cochran, who himself was a Black gentleman who had made a name for himself in sort of civil rights circles making those cases. And he had been himself on the receiving end of not exactly police brutality, but definitely racial profiling. He very much felt that there was a targeting of the Black community by the LAPD. Another one of his trial attorneys was Robert Shapiro, who was for a while the lead counsel until it was made to be Johnny Cochran. And that was a whole thing between them. They had a very unpleasant, aggressive kind of relationship, Johnny Cochran and Robert Shapiro, who were two of these big lawyers for O.J. Simpson. One of O.J. Simpson's longtime friends was Robert Kardashian. And yes, you do recognize that last name. As we mentioned in episode one, Robert Kardashian was the father to the Kardashian children. Robert Kardashian vehemently defended OJ. They were really close friends. And as the evidence began to pile up, his trust and belief in his friend was eroded and eroded to the point where he really did not believe anymore that OJ was innocent. There's just too much evidence.
His doubt was, it grew and it grew. He seemed like he believed him at first, and then over the course, it didn't really seem to take too long before he kind of started to see through the bullshit. And also, too, because he was in such a personal relationship with OJ, his ex-wife, Chris, at this point, she was Chris Jenner because she was already married. This is when she was married to Bruce Jenner before they got divorced and he became Caitlyn. Chris was one of Nicole's closest friends. It really drove a wedge. They already seemed to have a pretty tense post-divorce life with one another. And so when he was on the defense counsel with OJ and his dream team, it really stoked the fires. And she was really upset with him over it. Like, how could you? This was our friend and he did this. And at first he didn't believe it. But then over the course of time, he really started to see the writing on the wall and really started to lose his faith in his friend's innocence. He really doubted it.
It was kind of sad to see that. I thought it was quite well done by David Schwimmer, who you might know as Ross from Friends.
Yeah, he was good in it.
Yeah, it's very sad.
Usually he's kind of whiny.
He is kind of whiny.
Well, I guess he was kind of whiny in this too, but...
That's just his thing.
He is, but he was very good in this.
So an understanding of forensic science is kind of a huge hurdle that the prosecution team couldn't overcome. They couldn't get the jurors to understand the DNA testimony. They couldn't help them understand key evidence.
To the jurors, it just didn't really seem like a relevant piece to the puzzle. They were looking at what the photos were. They were looking at the evidence, hard evidence collected. DNA didn't compute with this jury.
It didn't compute, and it didn't make sense to them. And they were just like, you know, oh, here comes a talking head. Wow, wow, wow. I don't really get it. You know, they didn't really regard it. They disregarded it. Anyway, so that evidence really became useless in the trial.
Even though it was such an important part because it showed that all three, Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson, and OJ's DNA was 100% together. Mm-hmm. It showed him there. It showed the evidence in the car. It showed the evidence on his socks. Her blood was on his socks. There was so much that had pointed back to it. But the unfortunate part of that is that had it been today, people would have been like, he would have gotten the death penalty.
He absolutely would have, because it's just such a different faith.
Although, I mean, it's California. We don't really put anybody to death. We say we're going to, but we don't do it.
Just keep them alive forever and give them a room of therapy.
You're on death row, but you're going to die of natural causes. Richard Ramirez.
Oh, God. Ew. So one of the questions that people ask a lot is, how did we get to not guilty when there's all this evidence? And there was a lot, despite the fumblings and the incompetence. There was a lot of freaking evidence. There was his blood in all these places, as you mentioned. There was the timing. There was an overwhelming amount of physical evidence.
There was the Bronco chase, for Christ's sake.
For Christ's sake.
An innocent man doesn't do that.
That's right. He also left what could be interpreted as a suicide note.
4 pages.
Right, exactly. That doesn't sound like the ramblings of an innocent man.
No.
Let's just put it that way.
Remember me as I was and not the lost person I've become, I think is something that he said, something to that effect in it.
Right. Doesn't have that ring of innocence to it.
Doesn't read innocent to me.
So one of the main problems of this trial, so in any trial, the jury's asked to listen to both sides. And they have to really feel that their choice of innocent or guilty is beyond a reasonable doubt. And this concept of reasonable doubt was just flayed alive and roasted and spit roasted and chewed over again and again and again by both sides about what this meant. It was particularly hard for the jury in this case to feel like their decision was beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was because of the success of the defense team in creating this impression of doubt. This was their strategy. Their strategy was to attack every piece of evidence. Why are you submitting that? You want 100 hairs from my client to test for the hairs? You get one hair. You want more? 100 hairs is absolutely ridiculous. Like 100 hairs is completely normal, but the jury doesn't know that. So the jury was not able to achieve this feeling that there was reasonable doubt. And the public already was so enamored of O.J. Simpson. He was likable. He was charismatic. You know, he had risen from, you know, poor beginnings through his own hard work, you know, to become this athletic star. He was a movie star. He was funny. He was handsome. He was charming. He had the beautiful wife and the kids. You know, he was a very successful Black man in America in a very sort of palatable packaging for white people to enjoy him too. And it's a sad truth. But at that time, you know, in the mid-90s, the two different arguments of the different teams, the prosecution and defense, were really opposite each other. The defense was saying, there's too many doubts about the sloppy police work. There's too many doubts about Mark Furman. Did he plant evidence? He took the fifth. Maybe he did.
He lied under oath.
He lied under oath. He wouldn't say what he did. He's a racist. He said the N-word. There's all this stuff. And one of these pieces alone would not have been sufficient to sway the jury. But the defense team, the dream team, they were very canny. Call them what you will. Yes, they did get a guilty man acquitted, but they're very good at their jobs.
Yeah. That's why they got that salary.
That's why they got their salary. He was paying $50,000 a day for that team.
Damn. So. And also too, speaking of which, that trial lasted like 260 some odd days, I think. So $50,000 a day.
I know it's a vast amount of money. I know some of them were working pro bono, but many of them weren't.
$50,000 a day.
I know, right? That's like more than Linda Evangelista earns for getting out of bed.
She doesn't get out of bed for less than $10,000. The Kardashian crew did not get out of bed for less than $50,000.
If that's what you can command, baby. Another aspect of the juror's choice is related to the beating of Rodney King and the subsequent race riots. There was a feeling, and some of the jurors admitted later, that their not guilty verdict was retaliation or a retribution or punishment for the acquittal of those white police officers.
Yeah, that jury was pretty divided that way. And also, they had been sequestered that entire time. How gross is this? The jury was actually treated much like a prisoner in the sense of they were not allowed TV. Of course, this was way before smartphone. They didn't have any kind of form of entertainment. They were
magazines, no TV.
Anything that they read was censored. They could maybe have books or whatever. I think they had pre-approved shows that they could watch, but that was, you know, kind of problematic because they couldn't get all these people to agree on one show.
It was like VHS, basically.
Yes.
They brought you like VHS.
Yeah, video. Blockbuster rentals, and you had a whole grip of people in there that, you know, had different interests, had different things that they liked to watch, and people were like, you know, wanting to watch their regular shows, and other people were like, fuck that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and imagine the frustration. You're sequestered, you're in this hotel, you think, oh, well, you know, it'll be a few weeks or whatever, I'll see my family in a little bit. You can't leave your room, you're on lockdown. You have no entertainment. You haven't got your spouse there. And when you do have your spouse there, like, you are allowed a conjugal visit. Come on.
It's like prison. It's like prison.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, it's honestly, it was a prison for these people. So by the time all of this was said and done and the jury was already divided, there was the race situation at this time when that was just the temperature of that particular situation was so high. The jury just wanted to go the fuck home. Probably a good chunk of them lost their jobs at that point because almost a year, you can't do anything about that. Like, you know, they're just like, fuck it, not guilty, bye.
Yeah. And that's very much worth noting. You were right at the end. So after closing arguments are made, the jury goes into recess to deliberate, and the prosecution and the defense are like, okay, peace out. You know, we're going to go on vacation. It's going to be weeks, probably, and days at the very least, but probably a long time till we hear from this jury. They've got all this evidence to go through and all this testimony to go through. 4 hours later. Everyone was completely shocked by that. That was a very quick turnaround for a trial that had taken, was it, you said 268 days or something?
It was over 260 days, yeah. It was somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah. And then to have this done in 4 hours, you can see how done they were. And they came back with a not guilty verdict. It was unanimous in that everyone agreed. Later, several jurors said that they felt like it should have been a guilty verdict, but it was evident that some of the other jurors were never going to budge, no matter what. People who said straight out, there is nothing you can do, there is no evidence that you can provide that will convince me that he is guilty.
Yeah. And at that point, for the other jurors, you have to kind of just put yourself in their shoes. I don't condone it. I don't necessarily think it was right.
I agree with you. And I think also for many of them, and I know for a couple of the people in the prosecution as well, there were the concerns that this might trigger another set of riots.
Yes.
The way that Rodney King's beating triggered those riots.
Exactly.
And like you said, the temperature is very high, very spicy, and anything could really set it off at this point. So that might have played into their decision as well, to just say, look, we might as well just do it in a way that keeps people safe.
Yeah. On the day that they delivered that verdict, as I said earlier, I remember where I was when the verdict came down. And I was at work. We all just sat there, everybody's mouth agape. It was just insanity. To this day, I believe he's guilty. I believe he did this. I 100% believe he did. So did the civil court and his civil lawsuit.
That's right.
With the Goldmans and the Browns. To just quickly recap on that, they went to a civil trial and he was found liable.
Responsible for their deaths.
Yeah. And he was ordered to pay like $33 million in change.
It was a big chunk of change.
It was a massive chunk of change. Of course, he didn't have that at this point. You know, I mean, we're talking $50,000 a day for the Dream Team. Like,
drains your bank account pretty darn fast.
He doesn't have a whole lot of endorsements left. Probably Hertz is like, sorry, pal. Mm-hmm. All of these other avenues that he could make money have sort of dried up, but he doesn't have the money rolling in like he once did. And at this point, I want to say his net worth, which I don't know how he's even pulled this off, but I think it's only like $3 million.
Yeah, significantly less.
Significantly less. The Goldmans are never going to see the money that they were awarded from the civil trial. Just the fact that there was some measure of right done and they were awarded something, even though they haven't been able to collect on that. And that's how that book, If I Did It, kind of came to fruition through them. And that's something we'll include in our show notes too, because it's a really interesting twist and turn and how that all came to be with getting those rights, because it took them a very long time. Years.
And they got pilloried in the press as well for trying to get the rights to that. They got portrayed as bloody-handed gold diggers who would try to cash in on Ron's death. That's not what they were trying to do. They were trying to control and take back some of the power of this narrative that O.J. Simpson was trying to cash in on, and also create his own narrative about what happened that night. And they're like, no, there's going to be a truth here. We're going to put this story out. We're going to do it our way. He doesn't get to do this.
Exactly. I mean, and it goes back to the original point of what money can buy. If you or I, God forbid, ever ended up in this situation, you know, we wouldn't have the resources to get ourselves out. We wouldn't have the public support. We certainly wouldn't have a book deal, you know, and OJ got all these things. Kind of speaks to his level of, he was kind of untouchable in that way across the board.
There's a different level of defense that you can get if you're willing to spend unlimited money on it. You get, first of all, people who have a lot more experience and a lot more wins in exactly the field that you are dealing with in law. You get their undivided attention, where all they have to do every day is bend their brilliant minds to solving your case and finding that loophole that's going to get you off.
Yeah. And they also know that the notoriety that they're going to get from this type of case is setting them up forever. Like, imagine what kind of fee would any of these lawyers be charging at this point?
You're one of the lawyers who got off O.J. Simpson on like essentially a watertight guilty verdict.
Exactly.
Sign me up, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's some good money if you can.
No, but seriously though.
So the O.J. Simpson trial changed a lot of things. There was definitely a legacy or an aftermath that happened. And that's one of the reasons why it is such an important case. And one of the things that makes it sort of distinctly different from many other cases that don't have this big cultural impact. So first of all, the case sort of moved the perception of domestic violence from this sort of private thing that happens quietly to a public health concern that affects everybody. Previously, that kind of hadn't been the case. Her death was considered to be kind of like a wake-up call for American women. And as a result of this, it kind of got momentum. A legislative act called the Violence Against Women Act was passed in 1994. Yay, right? It took a while until people put on paper that it's bad to hurt women.
But it's, you know, bad to murder your wife.
That's right. I'll take it. Happens when it happens. There were a lot of other sort of tougher new laws that happened that came out of Congress, the legislature in states regarding domestic violence. The number of women who reported domestic violence abuse has doubled since this crime event.
Wow.
So yeah, there's been a really big surge in awareness and reporting. In 1996, also as a result of this trial, Congress passed a law that prevented people who had been charged with domestic abuse from purchasing guns. Imagine that.
Huh.
Yeah. And by 2008, domestic homicide rates had gone down by 53%.
Wow.
So this, the impact of this case is actually quite huge. There's also the O.J. Simpson trial being a really great example of what not to do. A lot of lawyer schools will tell people this is a great example of how not to do a murder trial.
Yeah, I'm sure that it is definitely serving as a warning.
Exactly. This case also resulted in quite a few reforms to the criminal justice system. One of the most important things was how this trial happened. This was one of the first sort of almost gladiatorial trials. It was televised. That was new. Judge Ito, Lance Ito, who you can read about, who was very notorious in this case for maybe not having a stronger hand in controlling the media and maybe liking the media coverage just a little too much.
And maybe fanboying it on OJ a little, just a little.
Just a little fanboying there. Yeah, maybe not the best of choices there. But anyway, so cameras were barred from the courtrooms. The use of jury consultants to kind of like get exactly the right kind of jury and game the system, that was curbed. Closing arguments were restricted. You had to stay within a certain parameters. You couldn't just veer off topic and introduce new shit.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's handy.
And yeah, very handy. And there were new rules instigated for regulating witnesses and other participants in the trial from selling their stories, because everybody sold their story.
Shit, yeah. I mean, everybody lost their job, probably. They're like, how am I going to fucking live?
That's right. Marcia Clark, at that point, when she sold her story, that was, I think, one of the biggest book deals ever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was set up. She might have lost the fucking battle, but she kind of won the war on that one.
She did win the war. And she's got a slamming bod.
Good job, Marcia. Right on.
Good job. Yeah, keep it tight. There is a feeling also that the O.J. Simpson trial had a wider and more negative effect, and that was to really deepen the cynicism and distrust and suspicion about police testimony and about honesty in evidence collection and things like that. There was now this very strong sense that your chances of receiving justice in the United States in the judicial system were really tied to how much money you had to spend and whether you had good connections or not.
Yeah. Definitely. In the beginning, when we first started talking about this, it is so much about the money and his notoriety, who he was and who he is. Everybody worshipped him.
And lastly, this murder case brought quite a few changes to the way that law enforcement happens, especially things like evidence collection, chain of custody, new procedures, and crime labs that can really keep up with the needs of the trial. So there's a lot of things that came about from this case. It really exposed a lot of weaknesses in the system, and a lot of things were tightened up. Also, a lot of awareness and movement forward regarding domestic violence and protecting victims of domestic violence.
Yeah. I mean, if there's like a silver lining, I think that that's probably it, because it really did kind of give a voice to people who might not have otherwise had a voice.
Yeah, this is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And Kitty, you're going to take us out with some fun facts tonight.
Well, you know, I like to lighten the mood just a little bit.
It needs a little lightening.
After this. This is in no real particular order, but these are just some things that I ran across in the research. There was so much more, and I just sort of had to find the ones that spoke to me the most. And I find that the first one is that after the wrongful death verdict in the civil case, and the Goldman and Brown families were awarded that massive $33 million, O.J. Simpson stopped making mortgage payments on the Rockingham property. It defaulted, and it ended up getting purchased by the bank, Hawthorne Savings and Loan. Nobody stepped forward to buy 360 North Rockingham until some East Coast fat cat with his wallet showed up, and he bought it for like almost $4 million. Only to demolish it. It's gone. And that was in like the later 90s when that happened. He didn't want to put in any money to repair the house. I guess it had probably fallen into some pretty big disrepair from, you know, all of the neglect over the last couple of years that it had gone through. And OJ's reaction to this, He told the Associated Press, quote, "It's not my house, and I could care less. I walked out that door, and I've never been back. Rockingham is history." He lived there for like 20 fucking years. He lived there with his first wife, and then he lived there with Nicole and both families that he created with both women. To go back to the "I could care less" statement.
That's not how you say it, people.
If you don't care and you could not care any less, then what you're saying is I couldn't care less, not I could care less.
If you could care less, it means you have a little bit more care to give.
Right.
That's right. But irregardless, Keita, I mean.
Another one is in 1995. I thought this was really eerie. A guy named Michael Nigg, he was killed. He worked with fucking Ron Goldman at Metzaluna as a server. He was killed 1 year after Ron Goldman. He was on his way to take his girlfriend out to eat, stopped at an ATM, ended up getting shot. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I'd never work at that restaurant ever again.
I know. That was 1995. So, right, the murders took place in 1994. But they were friends. And he also appeared on a TV show called Liars. I don't remember that show, but apparently he was on it. This was kind of interesting to me. Remember we mentioned Paula Barbieri? She was a model. I haven't seen recent pictures of her. She was beautiful. She was like that, like 1990s, like girl you wanted to look like. And she was kind of like the on again, off again. She was the one who O.J. Simpson was dating when he and Nicole had attempted the final attempt at getting their relationship back on track. And then when that didn't work out, she was his first phone call. Hey, I'm not going to work it out with my wife. You still game? Anyway, she ended up calling to end their relationship on the same day that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were murdered.
Really?
But she was weirdly part of the trial. Like, you'd see her. I don't understand the relationship at all. Apparently, she said she had written a book, and it's called The Other Woman, My Years with O.J. Simpson. And she described a fight that they had had one night in Florida. Quote, "I thought he looked ready to lunge at me, to pick me up and shake me. He seemed to be fighting with himself, as if there were some other person struggling inside. A person who was wild and violent. A person who scared even OJ," end quote. And finally, the Bronco. I personally, okay, you know how I am, but I loved this car. I loved it then and I love it now, and I'm not going to say sorry. Apparently, in just 2 hours after the chase happened, the slow crawl chase, the Bronco, which was worth $1,800 at the time, according to Kelley Blue Book, sold for $75,000. You heard that right. It was sold, and there was this company that was going to rent it out. They did like graveline tours, famous murders. they were going to use the Bronco to reenact the chase and take people to Nicole Brown Simpson's grave. Like, have some fucking respect.
I would be so torn between being horrified by that and judging it.
And so interested, like, at the same time.
Like taking out my wallet to pay for it.
I totally have that thought. It's like the internal struggle. So apparently this guy named Mike Gilbert had intervened with this company that was interested in buying it. And he himself gave Cowlings the $75,000 for the car. And in addition to that, the car after this sat in a garage for years and years and years. And I guess they maintained it. They didn't do anything with it. It didn't get demolished or anything like that. But they would take it out. They would drive it every other year. They would keep it running. I guess they did oil changes. They did the battery maintenance, all of the things you would do to a car to keep it running. And at the time when all of this was coming out, it was like around 2012, apparently only 20 miles had been put on it since the chase.
Holy cannoli.
Fuck, right? Isn't that crazy? And so it was on display in front of the Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas for a while, and apparently was still in running condition. The final fun fact with the Bronco is that in 2017, it was on display at the Alcatraz East Crime Museum in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Also on display there at the same time was a temporary exhibit honoring Nicole Brown Simpson. It was to shed light on domestic abuse.
A little balance.
A little balance.
that's what this case needs, a little more balance.
Yeah, OJ was also kind of a dick in the sense of, so this AC Cowlings, who was also the slow crawl, he was hooked up with Marguerite. And OJ stole her from him and married her.
And they were still buddies.
He would do anything for this man. Anything.
He really would.
And that's all I got.
That's not very healthy.
No, it's not.
When Kida and I profile a homicide, we have to choose which perspectives to focus on. Perhaps we'll look at the perspective of the victim, or the families, or the witnesses, or the officers and detectives who investigated the crimes, or the lawyers, maybe the judge and the jurors, or the forensic investigators and the evidence they discovered, or the wider society, and of course, the perspective of the killer. We don't cover all these things, however, because it's rare that in one case, every one of these elements is particularly interesting. This is what makes the O.J. Simpson case so fascinating. Every angle seems to include some scandalous story or bumbling mistake or point of unique interest. It's a massive and convoluted case. At its core, though, it's the story of how two loving and well-loved people died horribly at the hands of one very dangerous person. It's the story of how families were shattered and lives wrenched apart. That's the close-up view. But zooming way out, the perspective changes. The O.J. Simpson case was a cultural phenomenon, an event remembered by people from multiple generations. Anyone between, say, 10 and 70 years old at the time of the trial has a memory of it. For the younger crowd, their memories likely include the White Bronco. For those of us who were a little older in 1994, our memories include finer details of the trial and the verdict. With all its feverish media coverage, dramatic courtroom surprises, missed opportunities, cringeworthy testimonies, and an almost comical cast of characters, this notorious case could only have unfolded the way that it did in the atmosphere of that time and that place. The 24-hour news cycle blended information and entertainment to keep people watching like a soap opera, and so the case moved along in the bright spotlights of OJ's fame and the endless news coverage. Many factors lined up throughout the trial in almost fateful ways to produce the unthinkable verdict, an outcome that was shocking and yet almost predictable in hindsight. After the trial, the national character took a turn towards cynicism. For many disillusioned trial watchers, it represented the cold truth that justice could be bought if you had enough money and celebrity power. On the other hand, jubilant OJ supporters felt that his innocence was proven by the evident corruption of the LAPD. Simpson's defense attorneys, skilled at manipulating a jury, introduced enough doubt to unsettle their trust in the evidence. After the Mark Furman debacle, there was no evidence, no lab result, no testimony that would sway many of the jurors from their belief that the LA cops were out to get OJ. The verdict would be not guilty, because a guilty verdict would be a victory for the much-hated LAPD. One commentator at the time said, "It wasn't so much that they wanted OJ to win, it's that they wanted the LAPD to lose." This is one of the most succinct and accurate summations of why the verdict went the way it did. We recently passed June 12th, which was the 27th anniversary of the murders. On that day, Ron Goldman's sister Kim tweeted about her loss. We're going to end this double episode with Kim's tribute to Ron, which will remind us that beyond the media circus, beyond the courtroom theatrics, beyond the shadow of OJ, this case is about two lives ended too soon and two shattered families. Kim Goldman wrote, "27 years ago today, my best friend was murdered. I can still taste the pain. I live every day with grief and loss. It doesn't overwhelm me like it has, but wow, can it cripple me sometimes. But that's okay, it's supposed to. The grief allows me to feel the deep love I have for my brother and reminds me to keep chipping away at life. I am exactly where I need to be, honoring and mourning my brother always. Ron, you are my other half. I love you more every day. Missing you now. Loving you always." You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide. don't care if it's the mid-90s as well. There's traffic.
Yes.
Yeah, a million years ago, dinosaurs and traffic.
Yeah, dinosaurs were on the 405 and they're like, oh, that was their horn. Yeah, exactly.
It's their horn. Oh my God.
I'm so tired.
That's okay. We're going to hold it together for part two. We got this.
Fucking amazing.
It's on tape, even better. It's preserved for all posterity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a fucking children's book right there.
Yeah. Okay.